Kia ora. This program is brought to you by Wellington Access Radio. Get your voice heard.
Haere mai ki te kōrero, te ara whānui ki te rangi, ko Oscar Toko Ingoa. I'm here with Voice of Aroha and Manomita. Kia ora, Manomita.
Hi, Oscar.
Thanks so much for your time today.
Yeah, lovely to be here.
Would you like to start the session by introducing yourself?
Yeah, sure. So I'm Manomita Das. I'm a PhD student at the Joint Center for Disaster Research, but I have already submitted my thesis and waiting for examination, so fingers crossed. And I'm also a research officer with the center, so working on a few projects around disaster resilience, particularly looking at how we can improve our community's disaster resilience. So that's me.
Wow, that's awesome that you're doing your PhD in disaster resilience. That's awesome. Did you do all of your studies in disaster resilience?
Well, my bachelor's, interestingly, is in IT.
Okay.
I have a bachelor's in computer science and engineering. I worked in the sector for around 2.5 years before I decided to do a slingshot to another direction. And I ended up doing a master's in disaster management in India at Tata Institute of Social Sciences, which is a really cool university to be doing masters in disaster management, and I had a bit of experience there, and then after that and a little bit of research experience after that, and then I joined Massey as a PhD student.
Wow, so that's awesome. What made you make the switch from IT to civil defense?
The short answer is I really did not like my IT job.
Good on you for doing it.
But the longer answer is that there is a place in India called Vishakhapatnam. I used to go there a lot with my friends, and there was a cyclone that hit that place, and I saw the pictures in news and media, and it was a bit, phrase it? It felt a bit unreal looking at that place, having, there was glass on the roads that we had walked on. So it felt a little bit too close to heart. And that was when I started thinking that maybe social sciences or something around emergency management would be something I'm interested in. And when I had applied for my master's, I did it in 2015. So right after a few months, there was, when there is a gap between the examination and your actual admission, there was this, the Nepal earthquake of 2015.
True.
And that kind of, I was like, yeah, this might be a divine indication.
Yeah, absolutely.
That I should pursue emergency management. So that's how I got started.
Wow. Whenever you see a cyclone or an earthquake or those forces of nature firsthand, they're humbling experiences for sure.
Yes, absolutely.
The absolute power behind those is, yeah, I can, that's part of what got me into climate and civil defense as well, is to kind of learn more about all of these systems.
Because when they
happen, they have a big impact.
Yeah, and I think we come across news stories all the time, and it often it's the sense that, oh, it happened there, but I'm kind of okay. But then when it actually happens to a place or places that you have already been, that's when that realization comes in that it can happen anywhere, anytime, and we have to be prepared for whatever comes. So, yep. That was quite a humbling experience, I would say.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I fully agree that we have to prepare for those events, for when they happen, because it's not if, but when.
Yes.
We live in a beautifully dynamic planet, but as part of that, there's a lot of weather we have to look out for. There's lots of volcanoes and earthquakes that have massive impacts. So how do you prepare for those sorts of things?
This is a very big question.
It's a massive question.
To answer it in a very short way, I think there are multiple ways that we can tackle this aspect of preparedness. So the first is by looking at how we can improve our behavior so that we are better prepared for that event. So we might learn our exercises like our drop, cover, and hold. We might participate in tsunami hikoe so that it's in a muscle memory. And when something like this happens, we are not overwhelmed and we are able to kind of act on that cue. And then there is also the broader aspect of community preparedness, because even if we survive the initial event, the impacts of that might last for a bit longer. So how do we navigate the challenges that comes in immediately after an event? And I think that is where community preparedness comes in, where you can have, let's say you ran out of something. Maybe you have a baby in the house and you are out of milk powder. And a neighbor might have that. So knowing those having those relationships, knowing who might have what resources and kind of connecting with them might help in working through some of the challenges that we face in the initial few months. And then there is also the broader aspect of the developmental issues. So often we have seen the communities where there has been developmental problems like food insecurity, water insecurity. Those are the places which have a much worse impact of an event.
Intersectional impacts.
The intersectional impacts, exactly. The other one, and that links very closely with disaster resilience, is how do we address some of those developmental deficits, and then that actually strengthens the way in which we can respond to our disasters. This is a very very short overview of it. And I think encapsulating all of these is the policy and planning process. And one thing within planning, which is really important within the disaster space, is how we do our land use planning and how it's being followed. So that's kind of overarching aspect towards how disasters will get addressed. So quite a few ways to go around it. You just take your pick and kind of tackle that on your own.
That was a great answer for a big question. I think you answered that at lots of different scales, from the behavior change to that we bake those muscle memories into our response, and we know how to respond. Like if there's a fire, we know where to evacuate. If there's a tsunami, we know where our plans are. And then also the community scale, where like the assets in the community and know your neighbors, all of those strategies, and then all the way up to the infrastructure and policy of our landscape and how do we govern our landscape. I think all of that totally feeds into our resilience and our preparedness. As an example of that, when the land use in Christchurch changed in the 1990s from kind of forested and more wild to industrial agriculture, it turned into one of New Zealand's worst environmental disasters in the 90s. It had such an immediate impact. That's fascinating. I think you answered that really well. That was a really big question.
but I think it's not just about New Zealand. I think these aspects are like in every country. If you dissect a disaster, if you look at the anatomy of a disaster, so to say, you will find these elements playing an element and playing a part, and that is a recipe for disaster. So
yeah.
If we are a bit mindful of some of these aspects before an event happens, then we can actually reduce the impacts of disaster by quite a bit.
Absolutely, absolutely. The more we prepare, the more successful our outcomes are.
Yeah.
That's fascinating. And from your experience working in both Aotearoa and in India, what similarities and differences do you see in how they approach risk and how they manage risk and community resilience?
Really interesting question. Again, many layers to explore, I guess, and I'm still in that exploration stage. I think one of the biggest differences is the fact that culturally, the two countries are a bit different, and also there is a difference in the level of development. So we can, so for example, New Zealand is a developed nation, whereas India is still a developing nation. So there are different sorts of challenges that we have to deal with. So for example, in New Zealand, the focus has been on individual preparedness quite a bit. And there is a strong focus on self-resilience self-responsibility for self, self-efficacy.
Honing your own skill sets, gathering your own resources.
Yes. In India, it has the approach towards emergency management itself has been much more community focused. So how do we, how the community can come together and stuff like that. And also, I think one of the and this is a bit tricky to handle as well. I think because some of the policies around health and safety are quite strong in New Zealand and they are very strongly followed. There has been there is sometimes a neglect in getting engaged in some of the tricky situations. Whereas in India, I won't. I might be politically incorrect in saying this, but some of the health and safety norms are not as strictly imposed. So it's much more within the community to come forward to tackle some of those events. So you see a difference in the way in which the community approaches events, where in some places you are waiting out for the place to for the floodwaters to recede, and then the contaminants to be removed, and then you take an action. Whereas in some other places, you might be like, okay, I don't mind the flood water, but I have to work around some of the other issues. And that has a relationship with the way in which community resilience kind of works out. And it's, like I said, it's a very tricky situation because we do need our health and safety norms, but also we do need our communities to be slightly independent. So how do we find a balance between the two is a tricky question that we might need to
flesh out further.
Yeah,
That's a really interesting answer. I think like how New Zealand has a kind of emphasis on the personal and the institutional scale, like we'll do what we can to gather our resources and gather our skill sets, and then we'll kind of wait for the emergency response to kick in. Whereas India seems to have kind of covered their bases more within the community.
Which again has its problems, because sometimes people might wade into, let's say, floodwaters to save something, and that's not something that you want to do.
It's dangerous,
exactly. So where do you draw the line where okay, this is okay, but this is not okay, and it's very different. It would be very different amongst countries depending on the risk tolerance, acceptable risk, and also depending on the resources that's within the community.
Yeah, that's fascinating. I think risk tolerance and acceptable risk is fascinating. From a New Zealand perspective, I think we include quite a large amount of risk in our response. Like in terms of water management, we're lucky to have such beautiful land here that has been used for farming, but as a byproduct of that, then our waters have been polluted. But the levels and thresholds of water pollution includes a high amount of environmental damage and chemical exposure. Like if I saw in my honours degree, 0.8 milligrams per litre of nitrates in the water was hazardous to the environment. One of the studies in Christchurch reported that over 60% of the waterways had 3 milligrams or 2 to 3 milligrams, which is way higher than 0.8, but the maximum allowable value is 11. Like, if 0.8 is problematic, then 11 is way too high.
Yeah.
That's really interesting. And is there anything you think that New Zealand or Aotearoa can do right now to increase our resilience or to respond more, either technically or emotionally or socially?
I think at the policy level, there needs to be a stronger vision as to what we want resilience to look like in New Zealand. So we do have our strategy. We do have our policies or acts guiding how emergency management is being done in New Zealand. But sometimes I feel that based on my very short experience in New Zealand, what I have found is a lot of time the policies or the guidelines that comes up are framed by an event that gets embedded within the institutional memory. And
in response to Cyclone Gabriel, we'll do this.
Yeah, which is a little bit problematic because we keep on redirecting our course instead of actually sticking to one and seeing where we go or incremental changes to kind of go where we want to as a nation. So I think there needs to be some rethinking at a policy level, at a higher level to figure out where we want to go as a nation in terms of being a resilient New Zealand.
Yeah, to consolidate that vision of where what resilience looks like, and then how do we get the stepping stones, and then gather the community to achieve that resilience.
Yes, absolutely, and that means that we have to tackle some of these tricky issues around community resilience as well. For example, sometimes I have seen there is sometimes it happens, and with the correct intentions also, that we focus too much on community resilience and we do not actually look that some communities do need resource access. So though we want to facilitate a strengths-based approach, sometimes the focus shifts to, you can manage yourself on your own and you don't really need our support, which is problematic in some of the communities. So having some of those critical conversations around, this might be a good approach on book, but is it actually working on ground and trying to work our solutions from there would be better. Some of the stuffs around that, some of the tackling some of those deeper questions would be something that I think is required right now.
I think that's really important. Like, for us to have a clear focus on the problem, and then how do we respond to that? I think that's super important.
Yes.
You've mentioned the importance of communicating risk. Are there any examples that you could point to of effective risk communication, or why is it important to communicate risk?
Again, I'm sorry to keep saying this, but again, a very layered question, I guess, because it depends on who we are communicating with and what is the purpose of the communication. So to give you an example, in some communities, storytelling has worked really well because that relates to the lived experience of people in that community. But also within some places, storytelling did not quite work well because they
like
wanted
too far removed
and also the fact that sometimes you want the facts that, okay, I understand it's a really beautiful and moving story, but I want the facts around this. So what works where is a bigger question, or who needs what is a bigger question. So if your community is already well aware of the disasters, then there might not be much you can achieve by storytelling about disasters, and you might actually need to present them with solutions or some other facts that they can act on. To come back to your question as to what has been effective, again, different strands of research, but one that keeps on coming up is actionable risk communication. So we can inform you that this is the hazard that you are facing, but what can I do about it is my question. And whatever you are suggesting me to do has to be relatable to what I can. So if there is a gap in what you are suggesting me and what I can do, I might not be able to take up that action.
Yeah.
So it needs to be actionable, it needs to be relatable, and also it needs to be coming from someone that you trust. Because again, people have too many concerns to worry about, and disasters is just one of them, and it's not an immediate one as well. It might happen sometime in the future, it might not happen, we just don't know. How do you prioritize disaster preparedness amongst all of these other things? And one way of doing that is if it comes from a friend or a community leader, and it's based on personal relationships, then you are like, it might not be immediate, but I might still do that because it's one, or because it's coming from my friend and they have done it, so I might do it too. So having some trusted communicator to embed that within our communication patterns.
That's another great answer for a really another layered question for sure. I think that's a really good point to kind of meet the communities where they're at in terms of like if they're already aware, then maybe more awareness is not needed, but maybe other techniques might be more relevant, like increased skill sets or community awareness or other ways to apply those additional resources.
Yep.
I think that's fascinating. How you mentioned like communities and like faith-based organizations and kind of social groups. What role do they have in coordinating this picture?
Oh, they have a very important role. I think they are key to bringing our communities together. So they have a massive role in all of this. So, for example, within the research itself, we have seen that communities which have, let's say, residence association, sports club, or even the knitting groups, often these are communities that are better connected. Mm-hmm. So when an event occurs, because people are aware of where there might be an issue, people are aware of the local hazards and they have the lived experience of being there for so long, they have the networks to know, okay, this person might have a generator that I can ask for.
Absolutely. So it's, or this tool or
this tool or this something else or so it's much easier to, you know, navigate an event when it comes up, and you're also doing it with a group of people that you know. It's not a group of strangers that you suddenly have to coordinate with, so that does play a massive role. And often we find people within these groups, like community groups, NGOs, or any community-based organizations, they play a leading role after an event. So definitely a massive, massive role, and there is a massive potential within them to, you know, lead the way in which community resilience is happening within the country, within New Zealand, and also globally, I would say.
Absolutely. That's an amazing another amazing answer. I think I really hear that those community players have a really large role to play in terms of building the trust and communicating that message and the community awareness and assets within the community. That's awesome. What role do you see youth or rangatahi playing in civil defence?
So they are the future for our country. So eventually, there needs to be involved within the emergency management space. Right now, I think people under 30 is often considered as a at-risk group because they might not be as prepared as some of the other groups. But I think there is a lot of space for for involvement of the youth, and I think there is a lot of good work happening with schools as well around the country. It just needs to be amped up slightly. And one really good way of doing that can be bringing in climate change communication and integrating it with the disaster space, because right now I find them a little bit disjointed. So bringing them together, we have amazing youth voices across the country talking about climate change issues. So kind of linking that with disaster resilience can actually help us build that bridge and also get our young youth interested in disaster preparedness, because sometimes disaster preparedness is also considered as a cliched prepper thing. That's not cool. But you know, having a different perspective or portraying disaster preparedness in a different way might actually help bringing more youth interest and having them more involved within the disaster space as well. So yeah, definitely looking forward to having more young people's involvement or school children's involvement within the disaster space, but we have a long way to go there.
Yeah, I think that's fascinating that climate and civil defense are often perceived as almost separate silos.
Yeah,
there's a lot of in between that really needs to be coordinated.
Yes, totally. And I think there is also another aspect that we need to consider, that the youth in New Zealand already have a lot of competing priorities, and that might be consuming their time and energy and effort. And it's also a time where you don't really want to think about what might happen. You might be living in the moment. So what might be a better way to, you know, engage them within a conversation where disaster preparedness is not one of those things that we have to do, rather something that's quite fun and interesting that you can engage with or engage with your peers. So some thoughts around that might be helpful as well.
Yeah. If it was up to me, every 16-plus-year-old would have to get like 100 hours at a repair cafe. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Get those skill sets in.
Yes, yes.
I think it's fascinating what you said before about like linking the youth climate movements with civil defence movements, because with the school strikes for climate and all the protests, we've seen a lot of youth momentum and energy and enthusiasm for the climate kaupapa. But then how do we translate those into civil defence preparedness and community skills? I wonder if they, like, if those school strikes for climate groups could either sidestep into civil defence by learning new skills or platforming different korero about those kind of community resilience?
Possibly, possibly, yes. So I think, again, school education programs are a really good way to get youth interested. Having a deeper conversation with some of these groups, some of the youth groups who are working on climate change and climate movement might be good to get them interested and bring them closer. Because at the end of the day, there is also that thought around climate change adaptation, and that needs to be weaved into how we are thinking about our recovery or reconstruction processes.
Absolutely.
So having that conversation with the different actors within the space would be super helpful. I don't have a clear answer to your question, but I'm pretty sure we will be able to work something out around how we can have a better engagement with the youth. But it's absolutely necessary.
Yeah, absolutely. I think I fully agree with you that youth are 100% of our future, and we need to include them in the process. What would you say about like cross-cultural conversations and how they collaborate with climate or civil defense or community resilience?
Really interesting question, because that is one of the projects that I'm working on right now. So we just kicked off a project, and it's just in the initial stage. But some of the things that that have kept on coming up is the aspect of messages not being relevant to some of the culturally and linguistically diverse communities that we have. A key point there is how we make those messages culturally or linguistically appropriate. So for example, I can't recall where this was from, but I think it's from some research in Australia. And what they did was they had the disaster preparedness sheet, and it was translated in different languages. But in one language, the messaging for how you tackle smoke when there is a house fire, the messaging was a bit odd for another community.
Oh, sure.
When you literally translate it.
And this would not just literally, but like it, spoken in that new language.
Yes, so it needs to make sense in the language often the something like long or strong get gone. If you translate it literally, it won't make a lot of sense because again you have a rhythming thing in English, but if you are translating it in some other language, it just the rhyme doesn't work, and then the context doesn't work, so it does not make a lot of sense. So stuff like that has been one of the things, and also there are two other important aspects as to expectations, because culturally and linguistically diverse community people come from different countries, and they might have different expectations of the governmental authorities and what kind of support system they might provide in an event, which might differ from the way in which it unfolds in New Zealand.
Yeah.
So how do you match the expectations with what will actually happen in an event in here?
Yeah.
And again, those meetings within communities with the community-based groups, they play a really important role here, because they are the ones that will inform you as to how it actually unfolds within the locality. And again, they might be the communicators who are more embedded within these groups.
I think that's super important. I heard there was a report from after Cyclone Gabriel, and one of the findings from that was that culturally and linguistically diverse people they didn't go to the civil defense community hubs because either the support was not specialist enough, or there wasn't enough cultural sensitivity or support, like men and women sleeping in the same places, or how food is prepped, or how the bathrooms are managed. Like all of those things require its own cultural nuance, for sure.
Yes. And we also have to keep in mind the fact that people who are in response are severely resource constrained. So how do we manage that within that constraint? Is a real practical question that we need to figure out when we are working with culturally and linguistically diverse groups. Very important aspect that you said, that often people did not go to evacuation centers. Sometimes it's also a culturally a cultural way of doing things. Like, for example, I know if something happens in my community, my first instinct would be to check with my other members and kind of go to, let's say, my my uncle's place and gather my nephew and niece before heading to a hub instead of, you know, doing it instinctively. So I think it does have the way in which you are, again, your lived experiences influence the way in which you will respond to an event. And untangle some of those bits and some of those complexities and trying to figure out what can be done to sort this thing out is one way. So I'll give you an example. Sometimes you will find a lot of elderly people are not very fluent in English. So let's say I am in a place which got flooded and my parent might be in my house. I might want actually to drive them to a safer location before keeping myself safe.
To help communicate for them.
To help communicate for them because they might not be able to understand that, or they might not be comfortable, you know, engaging with the local civil defense officials or the local community. So trying to kind of, you know, like I say, untangle some of these dynamics, some of these complexities would be really helpful. But again, like I said, that community-based groups have a massive, massive role to play in this because they know their community-based best, and they would be they are the ones who would be able to, you know, brainstorm and solve this and help us out in how we can work around it.
Yeah, that's a great answer, and we have so many more things we'd love to chat about today. Absolutely. I guess I have one last question for you. If there is anyone who's looking to get involved or wanting to participate more in civil defense, is there one action that you could invite them to do?
At a household level, you can do. You can have your first aid, grab bag, have your first aid kit ready, store a little bit of water if possible. And if you are really keen on contributing, do join some of those local civil defense, some of those groups. It can be a community-based group. It can be your local Red Cross branch for their disaster welfare and support team. Just anything, any group that you find yourself attracted to, just join them. And that would be a great first step forward, I guess.
That's a great answer. Whatever your skill set, we need you. Hide in my... Your skill set is welcome. Well, thank you so much for all of your time and your answers and your expertise. It's been awesome having you here to Kōrero. And then, yeah, like I said, there's so much more we'd love to chat to you about. But unfortunately, that's all the time we've got for today. So thank you so much. And for our listeners, we'd be interested to hear what you think in the comments. Thanks so much.
That program was brought to you by Wellington Access Radio. Get your voice heard. Thanks New Zealand On Air for funding accessmedia.nz.